it may go from bad to worse. I think things are about to actually get significantly worse for Donald Trump.
Well, we'll see. Promises, promises. Where have I heard that before?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's one reason.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950 KTNF, amongst other fine terrestrial affiliates. And yes, we stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me and everyone I know, but I don't know many people, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. That chuckle you hear is Desiree Doyen.
Yes, it is.
Always at our side. How are you, Desiree?
Doing all right.
All right, good. Let's see if I can ruin that for you today. But you know what? Let's start with a shot of dopamine that I think we might need to help us make it through the rest of the hour here, maybe the rest of the year. We'll see. Alan Lichtman, a distinguished professor of history at American University, has made a name for himself, according to USA Today today, through one unusual talent, as they describe it. He has correctly predicted the outcome of 9 elections out of the 10 most recent presidential races using a model that he invented known as the 13 keys. Now, you might say, well, a lot of good that does for us. His system may be good, but it's not perfect. He got one wrong out of the last 10. So we can't count on that guy. Well, maybe, because the only election out of those 10 that he's actually gotten wrong was, actually, Desi, can you guess which one it was?
I have a guess.
Go ahead.
Al Gore, 2000.
Very good.
Because Al Gore actually won that election when all of the ballots were counted in Florida.
There you go. The 2000 presidential election when he had selected Al Gore over George W. Bush. In a prediction that he insists as well was the correct choice, he says that the 2000 election was stolen. Man after my heart. Anyway, hard to disagree with him on that point, to be frank. So, according to the American University's website, the 13 keys to the 13 keys method are mostly objective landmarks that can be measured in the run-up to each presidential contest. Number one, for example, party mandate. After the midterm elections, does the incumbent party in the White House hold more seats in the U.S. House of Representatives than after the previous midterm elections? Now, the answer in this case would be no. In 2019, after the last previous midterm, the previous midterm election back in 2018, Democrats ended up holding 234 seats in the House, whereas after the 2022 midterms, Democrats ended up holding 212 seats. So, as I understand it, that would be one mark against the Democratic candidate, in this case, Joe Biden. So that's the first of the 13 keys. Number two,
the contest. There is no serious contest for the incumbent party nomination. And that's true. There's no real serious, there hasn't been any contest at all, I guess, unless you count Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson and so forth, who barely made a dent.
Yeah, you said serious, serious challenge.
Right. So that seems to fall to Biden's side. Incumbency. The incumbent party candidate is the sitting president. Well, yes, that is the case. Number four, third parties. There is no significant third party or independent campaign. Well, there are third party challenges here. Whether they are seen as significant under this method, well, that's not yet clear, I think. The method also looks at the short-term economy. The economy is not in recession during the election campaign. Well, it's not in recession right now, for sure. It looks at the long-term economy. Real per capita economic growth during the term equals or exceeds mean growth during the previous two terms. That is well above my pay grade. But you get the gist. Other keys in the 13-key method include policy changes, social unrest. Well, that could be a problem for the incumbent. Scandal for the incumbent administration. I haven't seen much of that. Foreign and military failures and successes, the charisma of the incumbent and the challenger, etc. So he basically goes down those 13 keys, answers those 13 questions, and is able to come up with at least 9 out of the last 10 presidential elections, who is going to be the winner? Now, Lichtman, in this case, is not slated to give his official prediction until August of this year, but so far, he told The Guardian recently, he thinks Joe Biden has the upper hand under the 13 keys method. So there's your dopamine shot for the day. You're welcome.
A little shot of hope.
I hope it, a little hopium, shot of hopium there. I hope it helps you get through the day. Lichtman told The Guardian, quote, a lot would have to go wrong for Biden to lose. But of course, as we frequently say, what could possibly go wrong? Yeah, exactly. Anyway, hope that helps you make it through the day. I found it interesting. More interesting, frankly, than seeing polling numbers. And polling numbers have been improving for Joe Biden, but I don't know. For some reason, I have more confidence in Lichtman's prediction, his method here, than I do in the polls. Meanwhile, in other news today, New York Judge Juan Merchan issued a ruling on Tuesday finding Donald Trump in criminal contempt of court for, quote, willfully disobeying a lawful mandate 9 times this month, saying that Trump violated the court's gag order prohibiting him from attacking witnesses, jurors, and family members of prosecutors or of the court itself by criticizing expected trial witnesses. The court rejects defendants' arguments and finds that the people have established, the people being New York here, the state of New York, the prosecutors, finds that the people have established the elements of criminal contempt beyond a reasonable doubt. The ruling states in 9 of the 10 instances he violated the gag order, 9 of the 10 instances that were submitted to the court by prosecutors last week. 9 of 10. 2 stories in a row where we dealt with 9 of 10.
I know.
Anyway, quote, defendant violated the order by making social media posts about known witnesses pertaining to their participation in this criminal proceeding and by making public statements about jurors in this criminal proceeding. The 9 incidents represent 7 posts on his social media site and 2 posts on Trump's campaign website. He was fined $1,000 for each violation and was ordered to pay the fine by the close of business Friday. He was also ordered to remove the offending post by 2:15 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday. And yes, Trump subsequently removed those offending posts in order to meet the court-mandated deadline. Merchan also threatened incarceration if Trump willfully violates the gag order again, lamenting that state law in New York actually prevents him from imposing a penalty of more than $1,000 and or 30 days in jail for each violation. Those are his choices for each of these 9 violations. $1,000 fine, and or 30 days in jail. And in his ruling, Justice Mershon opined that the law would be much more useful to him, certainly in this case, if it allowed him to impose a penalty more commensurate with a defendant's wealth. For example, he notes a penalty could be $2,500 or it could be $150,000 for each incident. But he doesn't have the ability to do that. And since he can't, he noted specifically that jail incarceration is now the only other option that he has to escalate the penalties for any further violations. Got it? Therefore, he said, quote, defendant is hereby warned that the court will not tolerate continued willful violation of its lawful orders and that if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, it will impose an incarceratory punishment, he wrote. The gag order restricts prosecutors as well and the defense from commenting on court figures outside of the courtroom. Since last week's hearing on the matter, on this criminal contempt matter for violating the gag order, and before Justice Mershon issued his ruling on Tuesday, prosecutors subsequently flagged another four comments that Trump has made since last week's hearing on this very issue, including comments about Michael Cohen and former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker, who was the first witness called by the prosecution. Mershon has scheduled another hearing on Thursday this week to address those four comments.
Well, I'm glad that he I think that it was smart of Judge Mershon to have said, OK, here's your warning. I'm not going to impose incarceration right away. But I did find that the judge saying, hey, reposting other people's comments. Yeah, you can't try to get away with gaming the gag order rules. Well, that counts, too.
And that was interesting. And hopefully we'll talk about it tomorrow if we're able to do a Trump trial catch up day. And we'll talk about that a bit more because he noted in his ruling that there's really no case law on this, that he had to go with common sense here and, you know, made clear that, yeah, common sense says that it's obvious if you are reposting someone else who has said something, then you are essentially endorsing that point of view, and that violates the gag order.
Right.
So we will see. And we will see, by the way, since that's a case of first impression, whether that can move on up the line and be appealed and so forth. In any event, we'll see if these penalties, as small as they currently are, change Trump's behavior in any way, given that jail, for now, is presumably the next step if he continues to violate the order following Tuesday's ruling. But there is another element of note to this criminal contempt finding issued earlier on Tuesday that I expect we may hear more about in the days ahead. Former federal prosecutor and legal analyst Glenn Kirshner warned on Monday, as you heard at the top of the show, that if Justice Mershon decides Donald Trump violated his gag order, well, it could have knock-on consequences in all of his four criminal trials, criminal cases right now. Speaking to MSNBC, Kirshner said the conditions of Trump's bail in every indictment that he faces include that he will not commit any other crimes. If Trump is held in contempt of court, he noted, he will have done exactly that. Let's face it, Kirshner began, we have a contempt hearing coming up where it may go from bad to worse. The minute Justice Mershon holds Donald Trump in contempt in violation of the laws of New York, that will represent a violation of his release conditions in all four of his criminal cases. He said that could mean that things get significantly worse for Donald Trump. Trump is, in fact, out on bail in all of these cases, in the Washington, D.C. 2020 election interference case, in Georgia for the same thing, in South Florida, where in theory he will eventually be tried on charges related to stealing highly classified national security documents when leaving the White House and unlawfully refusing to give them back to the government. And in all of those cases, he's on bail, saying that he will not commit any further crimes.
So, a world that we live in where we're discussing a former president violating the terms of his bail.
Yep. And what will happen to him? Well, maybe we'll talk about that again some more tomorrow in depth. On Tuesday, following the release of Mershon's gag order, Kirshner reiterated that point on Twitter. He wrote, quote, Judge Mershon finds 9 counts of criminal contempt for Trump. Of course, the fines mean nothing to him, but he's now violated the pretrial release conditions in all 4 of his criminal cases. Will the rule of law rise up and deal with America's most dangerous defendant, he asks. We shall see. On Tuesday, other witnesses to take the stand on behalf of the prosecution in the 2016 election interference case in New York included the archivist of C-SPAN to authenticate a number of Trump rally videos that prosecutors sought to introduce as evidence in the case. Michael Cohen's banker took the stand. He testified to the account that the bank account that Cohen had set up at the bank for a shell company. The banker says he didn't know it was a shell company, but the shell company whose sole purpose apparently appears to have been to receive the $130,000 that Cohn got on loan when he took out a second mortgage on his house to pay the hush money to porn star Stormy Daniels, who claims to have had a sexual tryst with Donald Trump, to pay her that money in the weeks just before the 2016 election to help him try to win it. That witness, banker Gary Faro, said that the transaction was very quick. I should be clear, we're talking about the bank transaction here, not Stormy and Trump's. Anyway.
Yeah.
The transaction was very quick. Within hours after the account was opened, the money was received from the mortgage and then almost immediately transferred to the trust account of Stormy Daniels' then attorney, a guy by the name of Keith Davidson, who was also the attorney for Karen McDougal, the Playboy playmate with whom Trump had an alleged nearly year-long affair with, and who was paid by the National Enquirer to catch and kill her story that was subsequently never published by the grocery store tabloid after its publisher and Trump friend David Pecker promised to protect Trump from negative stories in order to help him win the 2016 election. That, according to Pecker's testimony in the case earlier in the week and last week. On Tuesday, that attorney, Keith Davidson, also took the stand on behalf of the prosecution to testify about these transactions to his clients. Davidson testified how Stormy Daniels suddenly became more marketable following the release of the Access Hollywood videotape back in 2016, about a month before Election Day, in which Trump is heard bragging about sexually assaulting women. That when that tape was released just before the election, that apparently kicked off Trump's panic to pay off these women, to shut them up about their stories, that according to the prosecution's case in New York. More on all of that, no doubt, as the week proceeds. And I guess tomorrow, if we have another catch-up show, catch-up with a K, let me, in the meantime, take a quick break here because I got a lot I want to try to get to today, including a number of follow-ups to some of the stories we covered last week. Mostly good news follow-ups, I think, and some stuff from over the weekend that I wasn't able to get to yesterday, and some more breaking news today. And, by the way, our latest Green News report, which happens be our 1,400th episode.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Desi.
Thanks, you too.
And thanks to all of you who are kind enough to keep the GNR going for all of these years with a donation via bradblog.com/donate. Thank you. All right. All of which may, by the way, coming up, include a few more shots of dopamine. So don't go away. I know I could use those shots. All of that is ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Do not, I repeat, do not touch that dial.
Well, What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Thank you for sticking with us. Dopamine, or at least a shot of THC, I think, is straight ahead in some important follow-ups to a couple of stories that we covered on last week's Bradcast. Let's start here. As we covered on the program last week, in a landmark victory for organized labor, workers at a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, voted overwhelmingly in a 3-1 margin victory to join the UAW, becoming the first non-union auto plant in a southern state to do so. That victory followed up on the UAW's wildly successful strike last year against months-long strike against Detroit's big three automakers, where they ended up earning huge wage increases, benefit increases for workers. It was a huge success, and that has apparently helped to spark a much broader movement for organized labor around the country. The unionization election victory just over a week ago in Chattanooga was the first step in the union's $40 million campaign to unionize nearly 40 plants that are run by about a dozen major automakers around the country, and predominantly at plants in the South, which has long been regarded as a citadel against unionizations. Well, with the Volkswagen victory then under its belt from just a week or so ago, late last week, the UAW did it again as the union reached an 11th-hour deal on Friday with Daimler Truck in North Carolina that gave workers 25% pay raises over the next 4 years and averted a strike that would have begun on Saturday last weekend. The union had said it was ready to walk out if it could not agree on a new contract covering 7,300 Daimler employees. The previous contract expired last Friday. The German company has 4 factories in North Carolina. The union also represents workers at parts distribution centers in Atlanta and Memphis. At those 4 factories, they build Freightliner and Western Star trucks and Thomas-built buses. The deal, which includes profit sharing, automatic cost of living increases, and equalizes pay among workers at the North Carolina factories, marks yet another victory for the UAW, according to the New York Times, as it tries to expand its power in southern states where unions have long been weak. Quote, "When that deadline came closer, the company suddenly became ready to talk," said UAW leader Sean Fain, as he announced the agreement, which will give workers raises of at least 16% the first year after they ratify the new contract. The union has adopted a more assertive stance after winning the biggest pay increases in decades for workers at Ford Motor, General Motors, and Stellantis, the owner of Jeep, Chrysler, and Ram, after strikes at the three companies last year. The gains for the workers at Daimler could also add momentum to the UAW's drive to organize U.S. auto factories, including at companies like Toyota and Tesla. We'll see. Workers in North Carolina said they have been struggling to make ends meet while Daimler racked up huge profits. The company, based in Stuttgart, reported record net profits last year of some 4 billion euros. That's $4.25 billion. That's profits. A 44% increase from 1 year earlier.
Good Lord.
So you think the workers ought to get a piece of that? The union points out that Thomas Built, that's one of the production lines at the North Carolina plants, whose yellow school buses are a common sight, has benefited from millions of dollars in federal subsidies for electric buses. So the company has gotten all of this money thanks to the Biden administration and the either the Inflation Reduction Act or the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. I don't know. One of those, lots of money they got. Seems like it should be shared as well with the workers there who are doing the building of the Thomas Built electric school buses. Thomas Built workers have earned less than counterparts at other factories, but the deal will now give them pay increases to make up that deficit. Unions are great, aren't they?
Yeah, especially because they're finally bringing wages for these workers in line with inflation and with the profits of the companies that the workers have ensured actually occurred.
Sean Fain said, quote, workers who make trucks and workers who make buses will get equal pay for equal work. Apparently, the people building the buses were making less money than those who were building the trucks. The agreement also includes provisions aimed at preserving jobs in North Carolina. Workers had sought more job security after the company moved some production to Mexico in recent years. Workers at a Mercedes-Benz factory in Vance, Alabama, as we noted last week, will soon vote on whether to unionize. I think that vote comes up in mid-May. As we quoted a labor historian observing last week, victories at both the Volkswagen plant in Tennessee and Mercedes in Alabama would be regarded as a, quote, earthquake when it comes to the unionization of the South. Though winning a big new contract for workers at the North Carolina plant, which had already been unionized, but winning a big new contract there will probably help as well. I'm sure the folks in Alabama have noticed. So that was one story that I want to follow up on from last week. Also another on Thursday's show, I think it was, we reported on the new grand jury indictment against 18 Trump allies in the great state of Arizona, finally, for their parts in the fake electors scheme that attempted to substitute fake electoral certificates in 2020, saying that Trump had won the presidential election that year, when in fact, Joe Biden had narrowly won the state of Arizona. 11 fake electors, including the state's former GOP chair, Kelly Ward, and her husband, and two sitting state senators, were indicted by the Attorney General Chris Mays in that indictment on 9 charges each of conspiracy, fraud, and forgery in their attempt to steal the election for Donald Trump in the state, along with 7 co-conspirators and close allies of Donald Trump, including his former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, his current top advisor, Boris Epstein, who has yet to be charged in any of these cases, attorneys Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, and a woman named Christina Bobb, who is both an attorney and served as a reporter, correspondent, I'm putting that word in air quotes that you can't see on the radio, a reporter on the far-right One American News Network, or OAN, during and after the 2020 election and all of its many failed challenges. As we noted last week, Christina Bobb, was recently tapped by Trump to become the Republican National Committee's lead so-called election integrity attorney. So, yes, the woman who is now overseeing supposedly election security matters on behalf of the RNC has herself been indicted on felony crimes related to trying to steal the last presidential election. The election integrity attorney is facing election fraud charges Arizona.
That's so Republican Party.
And now it's even more Republican Party. CNN reported on Monday that Arizona State Senator Jake Hoffman, one of the so-called fake electors who was charged last week of felony crimes, he's still serving as a state senator in Arizona. He was charged in that case. He announced on Saturday, after he had been charged in the case, that he has been elected as a Republican National Committee National Committee Man for the state. Quote, I'm humbled and honored to have been elected as the next RNC National Committee man for Arizona, Hoffman said in a Twitter post on Saturday. So, yes, even after his indictment, I mean, at least in Christina Bobb's case, she was named to be the election integrity, so-called election integrity attorney for the RNC before she was charged. This guy was charged, and then after his indictment, the RNC chose him to be one of its top officials representing Arizona in the 2024 election. CNN previously reported that Hoffman sent a two-page letter to former Vice President Mike Pence on January 5 of 2021, asking him to order that Arizona's electors not be decided by the popular vote of the citizens of Arizona, but instead by the members of the GOP-controlled state legislature. Quote, it is in this late hour, with urgency, that I respectfully ask that you delay the certification of election results for Arizona during the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021, and seek clarification from the Arizona State Legislature as to which slate of electors are proper and accurate, Hoffman wrote at the time, and thankfully Vice President Mike Pence ignored him. In interviews, Senator Hoffman had repeatedly argued no electors be sent at all because, quote, we don't have certainty in the outcome of our election. And to contest Democrat electors if they were sent. In fact, the 2020 election was actually certified officially by both the state's Democratic Secretary of State at the time and its Republican governor at the time. There was no uncertainty about Joe Biden winning the state. And those results have since been verified, including by Republican officials and even MAGA Republicans time and time again since the election. Following news of his indictment last week, Hoffman wrote in a statement, quote, let me be unequivocal. I am innocent of any crime. I will vigorously defend myself, and I look forward to the day when I am vindicated of this disgusting political persecution by the judicial process. While Trump, by the way, is not amongst those charged in Arizona, the details in the indictment suggest that he is the unnamed, unindicted co-conspirator number one. Why he as well was not charged, as he was for trying to steal Georgia's election after Joe Biden won it in 2020, when a bunch of the electors out there have also been indicted. Why wasn't Donald Trump charged? Unclear. But that's the news from Arizona today. Some good news for now. Anyway, out of the federal courts on Monday, at least until our corrupted U.S. Supreme Court gets a hold of this one, West Virginia and North Carolina's refusal to cover certain health care for transgender people with government-sponsored insurance is discriminatory, according to a federal appeals court on Monday, in a case almost certainly headed to the corrupted Supreme Court. It is the first federal court to rule in such a way. The Richmond, Virginia-based 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 8-6 in the case involving coverage of gender-affirming care by North Carolina's state employee health plan and the coverage of gender-affirming surgery by West Virginia Medicaid. After the ruling, West Virginia plaintiff Shantae Anderson, a black transgender woman and West Virginia Medicaid participant, called her state's refusal to cover her care, quote, deeply dehumanizing. West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey, however, immediately released a statement announcing his office's intention to appeal. Both states appealed separate lower court rulings that had found the denial of gender-affirming care was discriminatory and unconstitutional. Two panels of the three Fourth Circuit judges heard arguments in both cases last year before then deciding to intertwine the two cases and see them presented before the full court of 15 judges. In June of 2022, a North Carolina trial court demanded that the state plan must pay for, quote, medically necessary services, including hormone therapy and some surgeries for transgender employees and their children. The judge had ruled in favor of the employees and their dependents, who said in 2019 in a lawsuit that they were denied coverage for medically necessary gender-affirming care under the plan. The North Carolina State Insurance Plan provides medical coverage for more than 750,000 teachers, state employees, retirees, lawmakers, and their dependents. While it provides counseling for gender dysphoria and other diagnosed medical health conditions, it does not cover treatment, quote, in connection with sex changes or modifications and related care. In August of 22, a federal judge ruled West Virginia's Medicaid program must provide coverage for gender-affirming care for transgender residents. An original lawsuit filed in 2020 also named state employee health plans. A settlement with the health plan of West Virginia, Inc. in 22 led to the removal of the exclusion on gender-affirming care in that company's public employee insurance agency plans. So we'll see. Good news from this fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in this close eight to six decision, but good news nonetheless for now.
Yes.
Of course, given our corrupt U.S. Supreme Court at this point, as we have seen over and over again in recent years, it doesn't really matter what lower courts determine, you know, after things like weeks-long trials, in years-long cases where evidence is examined and expert witnesses are interrogated by both sides, the right-wing supermajority on our corrupted high court, well, they get to decide whatever they want to decide, whenever they want to decide it, even if it means overturning decades of legal precedent and case law and just making up all new interpretations of the law as they see fit to justify the end result that they wish to achieve. Evidence and experts and the Constitution itself be damned. That's what we get from our corrupted U.S. Supreme Court at this point, as I discussed at some length on yesterday's show. And that, by the way, is the opposite of the constitutional conservatism that those same justices pretend to follow. A conservative decision which sticks to precedent, which makes no major changes to the law, which certainly doesn't make up stuff that's nowhere to be found in the Constitution. That's what our current Supreme Court is all about. That is the opposite of constitutional conservatism, but don't get me started. Here we go. This one may provide some dopamine for some of you, or as I said, some THC, perhaps. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration will finally move to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug. The Associated Press has learned about this historic shift to generations of American drug policy that could have wide ripple effects across the country. The DEA's proposal, which still must be reviewed by the White House Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, would recognize the medical uses of cannabis and acknowledge that it has less potential for abuse than some of the nation's most dangerous drugs. However, it would not legalize marijuana outright for recreational use. But, you know, baby steps. We will take them after all of these years. The agency's move, confirmed to the AP on Tuesday by five people familiar with the matter and subsequently confirmed later in the day by a number of other outlets, clears the last significant regulatory hurdle before the agency's biggest policy change in more than 50 years can finally take effect. Once OMB signs off on this, the DEA will take public comment on the plan to move marijuana from its current classification as a Schedule 1 drug alongside heroin and LSD. Yes, for all of these decades, the federal government has treated pot under the law the same way that it treats heroin and cocaine. And would move it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3, putting it alongside things like ketamine and some anabolic steroids. That following a recommendation from the Federal Health and Human Services Department. After the public comment period and a review by an administrative judge, the agency would eventually publish the final rule into the Federal Register. All of this comes after President Biden called for a review of medical marijuana law back in October of 2022, and he moved to pardon thousands of Americans who were convicted federally of simple possession of marijuana over the years. He's also called on governors and local leaders at the same time to take steps to erase marijuana convictions at the state level. According to the president back in December, quote, criminal records for marijuana use and possession have imposed needless barriers to employment, housing, educational opportunities, and he is right. People who had convictions decades ago for, you know, smoking a joint out on the street and got arrested, those folks are, in many cases, still required to check a box when they are applying for loans and for jobs and going to school, et cetera, that they have been convicted of a felony crime. Quote, too many lives have been upended because of our failed approach to marijuana, Biden said last year. It's time that we right these wrongs, unquote. Biden and a growing number of lawmakers from both major political parties have been pushing for the DEA decision as marijuana has become increasingly decriminalized and accepted and legalized for fully recreational use in about two dozen states.
It's aligning reality with realigning the law with reality.
Yeah, exactly. A Gallup poll last fall found 70% of adults support legalization. That's the highest level ever recorded by the firm. It's more than double the roughly 30% who felt that way back in 2000. So again, they're all, you know, our theme song stuck in the middle with you. That's what I'm trying to say. They used to call me a lefty, and now all the people are coming to me in the center with the public.
Well, basically, the way to think
of
this is that
progressives
are generally right about these things, and it just takes forever for everybody else to catch up.
Schedule 3 drugs are still controlled substances, so even if it becomes Schedule 3, it'll still be a controlled substance. It'll be subject to rules and regulations, and people who traffic in them without permission could still face federal criminal prosecution. Many, in the meantime, argue that marijuana should be treated the way that alcohol is. I would join that argument. Last week, 21 Democrats, led by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York, sent a letter to the DEA and the Attorney General arguing marijuana should be dropped from the controlled substances list entirely and instead regulated like alcohol. So they would like the Biden administration to go even farther than it already has. The lawmakers wrote, it is time for the DEA to act. Right now, the administration has the opportunity to resolve more than 50 years of failed racially discriminatory marijuana policy. Federal drug policy has lagged behind many states, AP notes, in recent years, with 38 having already legalized medical marijuana and 24 legalizing it for recreational use. That has helped fuel a fast-growing marijuana industry, now estimated to be worth some $30 billion, which, by the way, brings in huge amounts of tax revenue in states where it is allowed for sale. Easing federal regulations could also make it easier to research marijuana, since it's very difficult to conduct authorized clinical studies on Schedule 1 substances. Now, you may have noticed, in recent weeks, there have been a lot of new Biden administration rules and regulations that have been issued on all sorts of stuff like this. You may remember the series of new regulations regarding student loan forgiveness in recent weeks. And in particular, as regular listeners of our Green News Report may remember, in the environmental and climate crisis sector, there have been just a ton, a cascade, I believe you called them at one point, Desi, of these of these new rules. And in fact, we've got a bunch of new ones, some very important ones, in fact, covered in our latest GNR that is coming up momentarily. But there is a reason that all of these things are sort of cascading out now from the administration. And for the cynics, no, it's not only because there is an upcoming presidential election and the Biden administration is trying to boost their reelection chances, though I'm sure that plays a part of it. But the election itself definitely plays a part in that, not because it's going to necessarily help Joe Biden, but because it leads us to a very important thing called the Congressional Review Act. Desi, can you explain the Congressional Review Act, or CRA, and why it's so important right now, even as we are still some 6 months out from the general election?
Yes, the Congressional Review Act is a 1996 law. It gives Congress great powers to invalidate rules that were established by federal agencies in the previous year. So after a rule takes effect, that means Congress, under the Congressional Review Act, Congress has 60 legislative days to pass a resolution overturning it, repealing it, disapproving of it.
Now, let me note here that 1996, that was when Republicans had taken control, I think, of both houses of Congress.
Yep.
They had a Democrat in office with Bill Clinton.
Right,
at the time.
And they did not like what he was doing.
They did not like his regulations. So what they did was they made it really easy for Congress to get rid of any regulations that they did not like. In fact, I think in the Senate, the filibuster
does not apply. It is exempt from the filibuster.
Exempt from the
filibuster. All it requires is a simple majority of senators to eliminate and repeal any regulation. So the key here is that it is 60 legislative days. And that means days that Congress is actually there in person. Not 60 regular days, 60 days Congress is in session.
So that can take...
That
could take 6 months to have 60 legislative days.
Right. So that's why, as long as a rule like what Biden is trying to do right now is published more than 60 legislative days before the end of a presidential term, it cannot be eliminated by a vote in Congress. In other words, it protects these rules. It gives them an extra layer of legal protection.
Now, this, of course, would require in the elections in November for Republicans to take back control of the Senate. They would have to take it only by, you know,
one vote
because they don't mind doing away with the filibuster on that, do they?
No. Nope.
Where was Joe Manchin back then, by the way? Was he complaining about them doing away with the filibuster? Anyway, they did away with the filibuster there, so it'd be very easy for the Senate if they have a majority there, easy in the House, and of course they would still need the president. So what they're doing is they would be counting on a Republican president, a House, and Senate to then use the CRA to overturn all of this stuff that Joe Biden has done, but they can't do it if it's beyond 60 legislative days, right?
And so right now, the guess is that it's sometime in May. We don't know exactly when. And a really critical aspect of the Congressional Review Act is if Congress invalidates a rule under the Congressional Review Act, future administrations are barred from creating a new rule that is substantially similar to the one that was just repealed. So it prevents it from passing again ever.
Right.
And so we have some major rules that Biden has put forth, you know, like tailpipe rules for pollution, you know, emission rules for power plants and stuff like that. A lot of stuff that is so far safe, we think, from the CRA, but we shall see.
But we shall see. And that's why you're seeing a whole lot of these things now. By the way, it doesn't mean that these regulations can't be reversed by a future presidential administration, unless they're in law. President can reverse them, but it takes a lot longer. It's a lot more work in order to undo them. That's why it's taken so long for Biden to get some of this stuff in place, because he's had to reverse a lot of what the Trump administration did.
Exactly. So in other words, elections have consequences. Choose wisely.
I've heard that said before. Anyway, that's a long preamble to take a quick break and come back with our latest Green News Report. Yes, our 1400th episode of the much-beloved GNR. Straight ahead on the broadcast, I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. So did anybody get you a cake or anything to celebrate?
No.
What?
Our 1,400th episode?
1,400 episodes and you get nothing. Oh, well,
yep.
At least our listeners get our latest Green News Report.
More heartbreak and destruction for people in Kenya.
Extreme weather grips Africa. Sea levels on the U.S. Gulf Coast are rising twice as fast as the rest of the planet. Plus,
one of the biggest environmental challenges facing our nation is man-made pollution.
New rules will slash air, water, and climate pollution from U.S. power plants.
All of that slashing and burning straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
This is a defining moment in history, a defining moment for EPA. One day we'll all look at our grandkids square in the eyes and we'll tell them that we all fought the good fight.
We may be telling that to them from our underground survival bunkers, but we will have fought the good fight. This is our 1,400th Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, before you get to the terrible news, here's some maybe good news.
Yep.
It's our 1,400th episode of the Green News Report.
That's a lot of green news reports.
That is, and I should take note that during that 1,400, climate change has only gotten worse the entire time.
Yes, we have failed.
We have indeed. What do you have for us today, Des?
Well, first, unfortunately, tragedy in Kenya. More than 40 people were killed after a dam collapsed in southern Kenya after weeks of torrential rain and flash floods that have caused widespread destruction, destroyed crops, and displaced more than 130,000 people. More rain is in the forecast. Northern Africa is grappling with a month-long record-setting intense heat wave. Several nations in East and Central Africa have declared states of emergency after months of intense drought, punctuated by extreme storms and floods that have decimated crop yields. A new study finds that coastal areas in the south and southeastern U.S. are right now seeing some of the most rapid rates of sea level rise on the planet. For Gulf of Mexico states, seas are rising at twice the global average rate. Since 2010, the ocean has risen an average of 6 inches from Texas to North Carolina, and the rate itself is accelerating. It matters because higher sea levels, combined with more frequent torrential downpours and sinking land due to overpumping of groundwater, are generating bigger flooding more frequently. And sadly, the researchers say the rise is irreversible and will get worse, imperiling coastal infrastructure and communities where 28 million Americans live.
And the rise is getting worse because of what we are doing to the coast?
The rise is getting worse for a number of reasons, mostly because of climate change and the way the oil industry has carved up the Gulf Coast. Air quality in some parts of the U.S. is now the worst in 25 years. The American Lung Association's annual State of the Air report says that air quality in the U.S. is far better than it was before the Clean Air Act was passed in 1970, but that steady improvement in cleaning the air stalled in 2017. 44 million Americans now live in counties with deteriorating air quality, mostly due to wildfires. Mm. However, this is a very big deal. Under major new rules unveiled by the Biden administration late last week, coal-fired power plants and new gas-fired plants will be required to cut or capture 90% of their smokestack carbon dioxide emissions by 2032 or shut down.
That is big news.
The agency also tightened rules to reduce emissions of the potent neurotoxin mercury from smokestacks. Coal plant operators must also reduce toxic wastewater pollutants discharged into waterways, and the agency also closed loopholes to require safer storage of toxic coal ash waste, a byproduct of burning coal that is dumped permanently in ponds that are leaching heavy metals into drinking water.
I have a feeling a whole bunch of new lawsuits are about to be filed.
Exactly. Republican-controlled coal states and industry groups have already said they will sue to stop the new pollution rules.
Because they want more pollution.
The four rules are the Biden administration's most ambitious effort yet to roll back planet warming pollution from the power sector, the nation's second largest source of emissions after transportation. The agency estimates the new standards will reduce climate warming carbon dioxide emissions from the sector by 75% from 2005 levels, equivalent to taking 330 million cars off the road. EPA Administrator Michael Regan says the new standards will result in massive reduction in pollution and hundreds of billions of dollars in benefits to public health.
All while ensuring the power sector can provide affordable, reliable electricity to consumers for the long term. These stronger carbon pollution standards will spur up to $370 billion, that's billion with a B, in climate and public health net benefits over the next two decades.
If they overcome the lawsuits.
Yes.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your 1400th Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Rock on, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
Well done. 1,400 episodes.
Yeah, wow.
And everything is just getting worse. Oh,
well, and it's kind of a big deal what Biden has done with the power plant rules.
Deal.
I mean, this is the first opportunity to try to finally rein in power plant pollution for the first time in U.S. history after the Supreme Court overturned Obama's attempt to do that.
So Obama had a plan to do exactly that. The Supreme Court essentially killed it because they're corrupt and said, oh, now it's moot. There's another guy in there. The other guy came in, put in a plan that made it easier to pollute, essentially.
Yeah.
Then Biden came in and now reversed that with this particular power plant regulation.
It's a huge deal. I hope it holds.
Yeah. Well, keep hoping.
Yep.
We got to get out. Did I mention we have a corrupt U.S. Supreme Court that I'm sure can't wait to kill it?
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll see. Got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. And hey, while you're there, please consider hitting one of those donate buttons or going straight to bradblog.com/donate. That is the only way that the Green News Report stays on your public airwaves as well as the broadcast. Thank you in advance. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog. She is Green News Report. Follow us both and send her a warm congratulations. Until next time, we'll see you at all of the above. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Maybe something's wrong with you that makes you act the way.